Welcome to The Art of Authenticity, a weekly podcast that explores what it really means to be authentic and build a life that's truly you, featuring in-depth interviews with successful business leaders, entrepreneurs, authors, and thinkers. By sharing their stories, daily practices, and habits, they will help you find a life that is successful and authentic. I'm your host, Laura Coe, author, entrepreneur, and coach. Welcome to the show. Welcome to the show. I am so excited to have Justin Richland here today. Justin is actually a very, very dear friend of mine and someone I love to talk with because he's always thoughtful, surprising, and above all else, he is super honest on his take on life. Justin is an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Chicago. He's a legal anthropologist, and he's the author of the book, Arguing with Tradition, The Language of Law in Hopi Tribal Court. And he co-authored The Introduction to Tribal Legal Studies, and it's in its third edition. I asked Justin to be on the show because I knew you would love hearing his story. He speaks so candidly about his struggle to find a life that feels amazing. This interview is packed with insights about how to build a life that is fulfilling and has meaning. I know you're going to love this one. So enjoy the show. If you like what you hear, please subscribe and write a review. Thanks so much for listening.
Hi, Justin. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Hi.
Thank you for joining me on this Thanksgiving weekend.
Sure. Nice to be here.
In addition to all of these things that he's working on, Justin is working on this cool new project with the Field Museum.
Yeah.
You want to talk a little bit about that? Tell us what's going on?
Sure. Yeah, sure. The project is basically a unique effort that the Field Museum is doing with their partners in Native America, working with Native American communities and artists to really get their voices heard and give them a stage. You know, the Field Museum has one of the world's best collections of Native American material culture, most of it collected from like the 1800s, the late 1800s. And but now what they're hoping to do is to bring Native American nations in to give their contemporary views about the importance of these materials, and also to give contemporary views about the fate and status of Native American peoples today. You know, there's so much misconception about who Native Americans are, the first being that they're all gone. And The fact is that they're still here, and they're still strong and vibrant cultures. And so they're working with Native artists. They worked with one artist, Bunky Echohawk, who's a Pawnee man and did some famous, beautiful stuff, has worked with various shoe companies like Nike and others on lines of shoes and sneakers based on his designs. And, you know, basically working with him. And now they're going to be working with two other artists, Rhonda Holybear and Chris Pappen. And they're going to be doing a show, and I'm working with them on putting that together, that show. That's going to be, and they're both also Plains people from, they're Lakota people, and it's just going to be fantastic.
And what got you, so you were in the museum, the Field Museum in Chicago, one of the largest museums in the country, University of Chicago. How did you bring these massive institutions together?
University of Chicago back in the 60s and 70s, and even before then, up until the 60s and 70s, was a very important place for doing work with Native American communities. In fact, Professor Saul Tax in the anthropology department, which is where I am at the University of Chicago, really staged one of the largest gatherings of Native American leaders to date in 1961. It was called the Chicago American Indian Conference. And it was really important for setting the stage for law and policy as it related to Native Americans going forward. But that's died off some for good reasons and for not so good reasons. And so I'm trying to bring this all back together. I came to the University of Chicago in 2010. And I am working with a curator of North American anthropology named Alika Wally at the Field Museum. And we together had been pitching these ideas of working with the University of Chicago and the Field Museum together to see how we can collaborate around some of the projects to reinvigorate their North American Anthropology Hall. And so this is the first step in that direction.
And what do you see as the biggest challenge to bring a project of this size together?
There are many moving parts, and you have big institutions and also some smaller voices that are equally, if not more, important. And the trick is to balance all of these different voices. You have the commitments of the Field Museum, you have the commitments of the University of Chicago, but you also have, most importantly, the commitments of Native communities and leaders themselves and artists. And so it's a lot of trust that has to get built up. It takes a lot of meeting and talking and discussing and making sure that all sides are feeling safe enough in order to collaborate in this way. And no one feels like their voice is getting lost in the shuffle. And believe it or not, we're so far doing, I think, a pretty good job of that. It remains to be seen what will happen beyond that.
Well, your career has been spending a lot of time out with the Hopi tribes, in their native land, and you're a judge for them. Is that right?
That's right. I am. I was appointed just last year, just this past year, past March, I think. A justice of the Hopi Appellate Court, which is sort of the Supreme Court of the Hopi Nation. I've been working with them for 20 years. Since 1995, really, in various capacities, working with the Hopi Tribal Nation in Arizona, and they are located on their Aboriginal land. They were never removed from those lands, which is basically 2 hours due east of the Grand Canyon, the south rim of the Grand Canyon. So right up in the Four Corners area. And I have had the good fortune and the honor to have been working with this tribe, like I say, for 20 years, and working with the courts in particular. I have a background in law, as you mentioned, and just this past year was appointed to their court, which is an incredible honor.
And so it gives you all those years in. I'm assuming you've built up some trust, and this sort of allows the conversation to move forward in large part.
Well, you know, I have to say there is some trust built up, but I think in a lot of the things that maybe we're going to talk about today, it's an ongoing accomplishment. You build trust, but it's a relationship. It's not just a thing. And so you have to continue to cultivate it, continue to work at it. And there are definitely times when someone lets you know when you have maybe not done what they wanted you to do. And the fact is that what trust looks like on the ground is not that everyone signs off on everything you do, but that right. They can tell you when you're doing it wrong without fear.
And, that's a great point, right? So trust is not just blind trust. It's the opportunity to have the dialogue. It's really, right, when you build
that's
that
right.
bridge and you're allowed to say when things are actually not working for you and people don't just walk away from the table, but they trust you enough to discuss that. That's a great,
that's
great
right.
point. Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, Justin, from the outside looking in, you have what most people would consider an incredibly successful life. You not only got your law degree, you're working on these incredible projects, you're a tenured professor at University of Chicago. But, you know, for me, success without authenticity is the real point of this podcast. Mm. So what does it mean? You know, we're friends. We've talked quite a bit about these subjects. I love discussing this stuff with you. What does an authentic life mean to you?
Oh, my goodness. Well, so it's interesting. You know, authenticity as a concept is really important to my research. My book, Arguing with Tradition, is all about all of these questions of what's authentically the traditions of the Hopi people is something that gets debated by the community themselves. And so many anthropologists have gotten it wrong when they've weighed in actually on what the authentic traditions of this community are. I apply that to my own life. So what the problem with anthropologists has done is they've weighed in, they've used their scientific lens and they've looked in and they've said for Hopi people and for the world, here's what the authentic Hopi traditions are. And that is sure to get you in trouble.
So they've defined authenticity from the outside as some kind of law, some kind of way of living,
or just a rule. they have used their scientific view to decide once and for all what it means to authentically be Hopi. With the, and you know, Hopi people are still alive; they're still here. And part of the problem is precisely that when you're still around and you're still here, the question of what it means to authentically live your life is not yet settled. And in fact, there's a great quote by a Hopi historian. They say, you know, these scientists come in and they want to know what the whole story is. They always want to be able to say once and for all the whole story. But the fact is that from a Hopi perspective, they say, no one knows the whole story. Each community within Hopi, each clan, each family has its own story of what it means to be Hopi. And the fact that none of us know the whole story means we all still have a role to play. We all are still figuring it out.
But I think it's so interesting to say that, I mean, are they confusing authenticity with cultural values, right? It's defining somebody or a group of people as authentically X, Y, and Z sounds more like a description of what we believe their cultural norms are, not really what it means to have an authentic life.
Well, and the funny thing is I think that from a Hopi perspective, at least when you are dealing with, and this is true of the work I'm doing with the Open Fields Project, is that the very point is that you may be sitting there talking about what our cultural values are, but we're living them.
Right.
And so when we're living them, we're in negotiation with what it means to be Hopi. And that's for us to decide upon and to, in fact, continue to work out. And for you to go there and say, well, this is who you are and this is what you do, misses the whole point, which is, what does it mean to be meaningfully living in this Hopi way? And, you know, that may not be something that we can weigh in on. But as an anthropologist, giving the space for that expression to come forward is what I view as my job. And whether giving space to having Native folks and finding out what Native folks say about what it means to be Native today, that's what we should be doing in at the Field Museum, it seems to me. And the project, in fact, is called Open Fields, because what we're trying to do is open up the conversation to actually have Native voices in there as well. You know, strange as that may sound, somehow we've forgot that Native people are still around and that they have a voice in who it is that they are. So we should be, you know, we should be asking, and they should also have the right to refuse to say.
Absolutely. And I love what you're saying, because the whole idea of authenticity for me is having that voice and being able to not only have the opportunity to speak from that space, you know, without the constructs or the influence of others, but feel the right to it within ourselves. And so,
that's right.
Having other people prescriptively decide what authenticity means for you. So to me, about as backwards as it can be to
that's
live
right.
an authentic life.
That's right.
That's amazing. I love that.
So you said to me, you asked me, what does an authentic life mean to you? And I would say that I guess, you know, growing up as we do in our particular culture, we have a real emphasis in our society on being able to follow our passion or follow our dreams or choose for ourselves. We place a great deal of emphasis on, you know, ideas about freedom and individual right to choose for them, for yourself, your own life, choose who you want to marry, choose what kind of career you want, and you know, choose what kind of family you want, and all of these kinds of things. And then somewhere along the way, you know, talking about people who, first of all, have the capacity to do that. We have a lot of social ills in the world that prevent some people from ever having those choices. But for those who are fortunate, deeply fortunate enough to have, like I have, you know, the first question is, oh my God, how do I even begin to choose? How am I even qualified to choose? What does choosing look like? And how does it feel? And
yeah, I don't know how to do it. Nobody taught me in kindergarten through high school or college or graduate school how to do it, right?
That's right. And I remember feeling like, this is the way I describe it to my students, my undergraduate students. I said, when you graduate from college, there's a few years in there where you are for the first time. If you were like me, it was no question you were going to college. That was just the story that you were told since you were in kindergarten. And thankfully, that's true. And so you went. And but then when you graduate, the first thing you realize is, oh, I have to write the script of my life and then live it at the same time for the first time ever. And that's hard.
Yeah, that's amazing. I love that because, you know, we are in such a privileged time to have the opportunity to choose. And how do we do that if nobody showed us how? And so for yourself, was your path to having an authentic life, you know, was that something that always felt natural, or was there a big turning point moment for you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're setting this up as if you don't know the answer, but as you do know. And again, let me say that this is one of these things where I am so fortunate to have had these opportunities that in some sense, and this is part of the problem, you feel bad even complaining about it because, you know, there are a lot of people, and I work with them regularly, some of them regularly, who just don't have these choices. And it's so sometimes, you know, I feel a little wrong for complaining. But the fact of the matter is that my experience was difficult. I graduated from college, and while I was trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life, because I was so fortunate to have that option, I didn't have any plans, and so got convinced by my folks to, well, if you don't, the line was, well, if you don't know what you want to do, why don't you just go to law school?
The answer for all Jewish families.
Right. Well, it seemed to make some sense. It was either that or medical school.
Exactly.
Lord knows I wasn't going to be a doctor, a medical doctor anyway. So, you know, I took the LSAT. I took the tests. I do. My father's a lawyer. My sister's a lawyer. My mother is a mediator. So arguing comes naturally to me and my family. So law school made some sense, it seemed. So I took the LSAT. And actually, ironically, I did really well, much better than I think anyone thought I would.
Which
I
is the worst, because when we're moving into a life that isn't necessarily that authentic, or we haven't really chosen, and we do well, it's even more confusing. Because why would you stop something that you're actually talented at?
Exactly. And so everyone is telling you, holy, this is amazing. And you're getting all of this kind of positive feedback from other people about what it is. And you're not really checking in with yourself about it. Is this what you want to do? And in truth be told, and I do think that this is true, I don't know that I could have I don't know if I had the information to know whether this was for me or not. I just was going ahead. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes we just have to do that. So, I was going ahead. I did really well. I got into schools that I could have never gotten into in undergrad, and that made all the difference. I couldn't believe it. And so I went to law school. I went to Berkeley Law School. Thankfully it was relatively affordable at the time. I mean, remarkably affordable. That's what it was. And I got there. I was 22 years old, surrounded by people who were very serious. Not everyone, but many, and who were on a track, and they were going to make it happen for themselves one way or another. And I was going thinking, this is 3 more years of college. I'll get to hang out and hide out until I figure out what I really want to be when I grow up.
Right. Yeah. But graduate school is not the same.
Not the same. Professional school, graduate school is not getting to hang out and think big thoughts. It is, it's certainly not professional school.
Yeah, I learned that one the hard way, too. It is exponentially more difficult.
Yeah, it's exponentially more difficult. And it is, it's geared toward, it's always presumptive. The presumption is always you're going to go on and become whatever the typical thing is. So you're going to become a lawyer. You're going to become a professor of philosophy. And you're going to do it in the way in which we have decided is the best way to do it, the most prestigious way to do it.
You're on that path. And if you love the path, I could see where it's just, you know, an incredible experience. But if it's not the perfect fit for you because it is so narrow, it can be very toxic.
And it was painful. I would say within 2 weeks of being there, I had realized it was not for me. but didn't have the courage of my convictions yet to decide that, and spent the entire year in pain, really suffering. And that suffering, first I was in pain and just unhappy. Then I was, you know, burying my head in the sand, just avoiding everything. And then the way they do it in law school is you take an exam at the end of your first semester, and then you take an exam each class at the end of the year. And so you only really have exams per se, testing moments, twice a year. And, it's an intense amount of work. There's an intense amount of competition, and I was falling behind, but I had was finding the whole experience so painful that I was just burying my head in the sand. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to face the music. And lo and behold, I kind of had a panic attack, in one of my exams. I literally got like a deer caught in headlights. I remember I sat down for one of my exams, and for 3 hours was unable to write a single thing.
Oh my literally. God. It's amazing how the body, if we don't listen to this authentic, you know, self, and we push through into spaces we don't want to be in, I find it amazing, person after person, the body will tell you eventually.
Yeah. And so I almost, that was a horrible experience. And I think I really was traumatized. I mean, here I was someone who.
Yeah. I mean, a panic attack in the middle of an exam. I mean, that it doesn't get more traumatizing. You know, did you finish the exam? Were you able to complete it?
Well, I mean, I sat there and then turned it in, you know, but it wasn't, I mean, complete, I don't know. But the way I remember experiencing it, and, you know, I remember saying, you know, I was someone who had come. So in high school, I was kind of a lousy student, but I managed to get it together. And so here I was in college saying, I'm never going to go back to being this kid in high school who was miserable and unhappy and not doing well. And then here I was in law school, once again, flailing about and feeling lousy and feeling like my brain had started fighting against me, had been refusing me, had been rejecting me. And I was struggling now, had betrayed me, really, my brain. So that was a horrible experience.
Yeah, no, it sounds like it. And did you, so from there, you left law school? Did you finish? What did you do?
I toughed it out, and I finished the year sort of miserable and with lots of therapy. and then I took a year off, actually, and enjoyed the year off that I had. But I was pretty shaken. And then after a year, I had to make a decision. Did I want to go back to law school? Did I want to try something else? And I was, you know, still just 23. Actually, worked at an elementary school, was an after school daycare person, loved it, you know. But then I went back to law school because I felt like, well, I'm still not sure what else I could do. Mm. And I went back and I thought it would be better. It wasn't. It was still very hard.
Isn't that amazing? So you justified going back using what language? What did you tell yourself?
That I didn't have anything better planned, and it was too scary. That the known discomfort was better than the unknown potential for happiness. And so I went back. I don't regret going back, to be perfectly honest. Part of me is still feeling like maybe I'm wrong about this, but there are times I think when you do have to struggle a little bit to figure out what it is you are and who you're wanting to be. And I didn't know yet, I think, in retrospect. Maybe that's in hindsight. It was still miserable.
I think that's fair. I think that, unfortunately, because nobody teaches us life design, nobody teaches us how to navigate from an authentic space, sometimes you just have to take the really hard path to learn, right? So you were learning, this is not for me, right? But you figuring out how to take life steps that worked for you was something, you know, sometimes we have to put ourselves through enough misery to change course.
Well, and I will say that I started making adjustments, even though I was back in law school and I was still unhappy. I was starting to make adjustments. So I started I started taking classes in philosophy, actually, that were being offered in the law school, that were the best courses I've ever taken, and they were like my salvation, because I realized then, starting in the spring of my second year, that I really wanted to be doing something in the arena of social theory, or at least a legal theory, legal philosophy, or some sort of social science of law. And I can remember that thinking at that time, I wasn't yet sure what that all meant, but that this was definitely the stuff I liked better. And I then, at the same time, was sort of trying to cover all my bases. And so did what everyone does in their second year of law school, which is interview for potential summer internships for the coming summer. Mm-hmm. And I did that, and I went to a law firm in LA. And in fact, I hated it. I hated it so much. It was clear to me that I hated it. I couldn't stand it. It was painful, and I did a horrible job. I did a horrible job. First of all, I'm a very good talker, as you can tell, and as you know. And so the talking part, I interview great. But when it came time to writing the memos and doing the briefs, and your summer of your internship summer is supposed to be sort of like, easygoing. They're trying to entice you and hire you and all this. I did horribly. I had two projects that I was responsible for writing these memos. I did horrible on one of them. I did okay on the other one. And the other one I did okay on because basically it involved more talking with clients and stuff like this. So they decided, actually, even though I hated it and was miserable and literally my eyes were twitching, I hated it so much, involuntary twitching, psychosomatic twitching. They offered me a job somehow.
Isn't that amazing?
They offered me a job, and it was at a really good salary.
Which makes the decisions so much worse, right? Again, like if it was just an epic fail,
right?
And not only are you twitching and having panic attacks, but nobody wants you. Then we move on.
Then the writing's on the wall.
Yeah,
that's clear.
Yeah, it's these in between things where you're actually reasonably successful. Money starts coming your way, but there's something deep within you that is revolting.
Right.
Yeah.
In that 10-week period when I was working at that summer internship, they were paying me the salary that I would have been paid starting my first year as a lawyer. And I got to tell you, I ended up making more in that 10 weeks than I would make over the next 10 years of my career.
Right. And our culture tells us, like, how can you walk away from that, right?
Exactly.
I mean, you can get all the newest gadgets and clothing and cars. And,
oh, yeah.
Right. And that brings happiness, right?
Yeah. Oh, I remember some of the young associates at the firm saying, yeah, man, I got this great car and I got this great apartment, and I drive from my apartment to this office and drive from my office to this apartment, and that is all I have time for. That's all I do. And so my car better be nice.
But if you love it, if it's really like, for some people being a lawyer is like a dream for them, yeah, that's fantastic. Not only are you making a ton of money, but you're doing something you really deeply care about. But,
right.
I think that financial payout can be so confusing as you have this whisper within that tells you this isn't what I want, all the way up to a loud screaming.
So I worked with them for the summer. Then I went for another back for my third year of law school, continuing to have this idea that I was going to go. They offered me a job. I just turned them down because I had in the intervening period gotten a lot of positive feedback for my work in the philosophy classes, in the social theory classes, and decided I was going to give that a go.
So if we could just stop there for a second. I mean, here you are making all this money. You've got this job offer. You've put so much time and energy. You've paid so much for your law degree. You're loving this philosophy. How did you make that decision? I mean, from the outside, right? That feels like a very difficult thing to do. What was it that swayed you over to the philosophy?
I can remember deciding. It didn't all happen at once. And there were several moments and stages in which it happened. And it didn't happen where everything, once I made a decision, it happened, you know, unproblematically from there forward.
Sure. No mountaintop moment.
Yeah, no mountaintop moment. But I do remember feeling like I just couldn't imagine spending my life in a law office. And also that once I had finished the degree, it could always go back to being that. Once I finished the degree, I could always go back and maybe go into law if I had to.
Mm-hmm.
That it's that gave me some backup. And so why not? I'm 24 years old. I'm still young enough to not have to have this all squared away. But even if I wasn't that young, whatever, you're always young enough to make choices. And so, you know, I decided I didn't need to necessarily go into something that I knew I was not going to be happy with at this point in my life. And maybe at some later point in life, I would be excited about that. And in fact, in some ways, I've gone back and there are aspects of my law practice that I do enjoy. And
use in your current work.
That's right. I mean, let me tell you, legal writing and research and formulating a draft opinion or doing stuff for the courts are it's a lot of fun. There's something that is very satisfying about it, but I didn't feel that way at the time.
Well, because it wasn't the field of law that was working for you. It was somewhere around the intersect of law and anthropology, right, or philosophy that was interesting to you. And, you know, there is a whole study there. And who would know that when you're 22 years old? And
right.
I mean, what would you say? There's so many people out there who are in that career. You and I are both in our 40s, right? And had you stayed in law and you had gotten traction and maybe you're up for partner or you're, you know, can see the partner route is 5 years out if you just stick with it, but you have that sensation, that nagging feeling, if not panic attacks. I had panic attacks on a regular basis and I was ignoring them. What would you say to that person who's really, really desperately wanting to make that shift, but afraid they'll lose traction in their career? And you know, doesn't want to, they have the house, they have the kids, they don't want to make that jump because they're too old, because they'll lose their spot in line.
Yeah. I'm not going to say that you're not going to be continuing to, that you're going to be able to just jump back into it if you wanted to. I don't think that that's fair and I don't think that that's true. It is a big change, but it's not a zero-sum game. It's moving to something else opens up things that you have never contemplated as being important to you before.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if you put money and financial security and all of these things as the goal, as what it is that is essential, then you need to be clear-eyed about that and realize that's why you're doing what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You're not doing it. And so for you then to go to work and expect personal satisfaction, to expect anything like that out of something that you've chosen because it's for financial stability is setting yourself up to be disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
So then I would say find your personal satisfaction, find your space of joy elsewhere outside of your work if you can. If you can't, then I think you have to have a good, hard look at maybe you financially take a hit for a while, or maybe you talk to your family and maybe you get down to brass tacks and say, I can't do this anymore. I may be being a good breadwinner, but that doesn't necessarily mean I'm being a good parent, or that necessarily mean I'm being a good person. And I'm not feeling present entirely with you and with my children. I'm not being the whole person to you and my family that I want to be. And so, yes, maybe money gets on the table, but there has to be some balance between getting money on the table and having a rich and fulfilling life. And the richness that comes with having a law job, you know, all of those trappings, all of those big fancy TVs, all of those big, you know, throw that into the equation, because that is what you have decided is the payoff for making money your goal, right?
And what is it that you've found on the other side that's made it worth giving up? Because as an anthropologist, obviously you're not making anywhere near what you would be making had you tracked through your legal career. What is the one or two things that you can say, okay, I gave that up, but this is what I have?
Okay, so what I feel like I have is I have set for myself my own sense of what it would mean to succeed, my own sense of satisfaction in a job well done, and feeling like I made a real contribution. And to be perfectly honest, in my situation, the money actually ended up following from doing a job that I could stand behind and feeling good and feeling satisfied in my work, mm-hmm. Feeling passionate about my work. I get to go to work and have conversations about, you know, humanity's greatest philosophers, Western civilization's greatest thinkers. And I get to spark these minds and I get to have really deep conversations and I see their lights turn on. And I can't tell you the feeling that I have that I find more satisfying than that. There is nothing.
The description sure is different from an eyeball twitching panic attacks.
let me tell you, I spend 3 hours. In a classroom lecturing, I spend between 6 and 8 hours a week. Now, it doesn't sound like a lot, but I spend about, 20 hours prepping for those 6 hours, and then doing my other work the rest of the time. I work much harder on this stuff than I ever did in my law stuff, but I love it. And the time flies by, and I get excited, and I wake up not with panicking, for the most part, not with panicking, but with enthusiasm about an idea I've had and something I want to write about or something. It's not all roses, though. Let me tell you. It's hard work, and sometimes it's downright. It is nerve wracking, and you do end up having to do things that you don't want to do. But if it's in the service of a choice you made, if it's in the service of something that you have committed yourself to, rather than feeling like it was made for you, that makes a huge difference.
Yeah,
it just is. It feels. I remember thinking, when I was in graduate school, I was into year five and going out to work and live on the Hopi Reservation and saying, I don't know if this is going to work out, but I can tell you I can't imagine doing anything else. And so in a sense, it's already worked out.
I love that. I love that. So, now that you're in this place, I mean, you've got the success. You're at University of Chicago. You have a career where you're feeling like I can't imagine doing anything else.
Yeah.
What are your daily practices or habits to, keep this going, to not, I've experienced the same thing, but I do find that sometimes that inauthentic voice can creep back in and start to sabotage the life that I'm living.
Yeah. I mean, daily habits, I'm still working on those, to be perfectly honest with you. I've just gone through a big transition. As you know, I moved to the University of Chicago from, California, a university that I was at in California. And, I'm from California originally. And so, and we moved in 2011. So we're almost at 5 years, 4.5 years now. And I can tell you that it's taken about this long to recalibrate and figure out what it is that what is it that I'm seeking to get out of being here, and what am I hoping to gain, and how is it going to work for me? And that period of calibration was anxiety provoking. It was stressful. It was sometimes downright depressing. But one of the things that I think I have found that really has worked is to give myself the space to be in transition. give myself the space mentally to be a learner, to not have it all figured out.
Mm.
Give myself the space again to acknowledge that what authenticity means is to not yet know completely what the answer is, and to not hold yourself out as having that expectation. And so that when other people do, because they're equally caught up in their own ideas about what it means, and they think maybe they are having misconceptions about what it means to be authentic. And so they think that you have to have it all worked out. That when you don't, that you're, and when they, you know, maybe try to ding you for not having it all worked out, you say, sorry, I don't. And, you know, you brush it off, because at the end of the day, you know who you are, and you know what you're capable of, and you know what you've done. And if you're not there, you're not there. And so no one getting mad at you for that is going to be able to change anything.
Yeah.
So what's it serve? There's a great movie right now out called Bridge of Spies. And in it, it's the story of this, it's the story of the Cold War, this Soviet spy in America, and this swap, and this Soviet spy gets caught in America, and he is facing, you know, everything from treason and to being locked away and thrown away the key to being executed and all this kind of stuff. And his lawyer keeps asking him, you seem so unflappable. Are you nervous? Are you scared? Are you angry? Are you upset? And his answer is always, would it help?
I saw the movie. Wasn't that great? Yeah.
There you go. Would it help? Would it help?
Yeah.
It wouldn't serve. So, you know, it doesn't serve to get upset. That doesn't mean you can stop yourself from being upset. So, you know.
But authenticity is not a place that you land in, put up your tent and stay. It is something that you continually work to keep.
Right. And so that's what I tell my students too. I have students now who are coming in there and they're, I'm teaching this introduction class to my graduate students. This is their first class they learn. It's a notoriously difficult class. Many of them have this experience of they were coming, they thought they were going to become anthropologists, they were committed to it, and then they get here and, you know, despite how many times people told them, oh, this is a really hard class, they're shocked by how difficult it is or how hard it is or whatever. And they panic. And I tell them, listen, it's not you who you are. You are holding, you need to hold on to your sense of who you are. Who's coming to class is one facet of who you are. Call it your avatar, call it your character, call it your whatever, and think of it as like a game. You're sending your avatar like a video game. You're sending your avatar in. It's level one. And you're coming in and your character needs to level up. And guess what happens when your character is leveling up? It dies a lot. it gets smashed a lot.
Right.
And so, you know, let your character get smashed a lot because it's still learning. It doesn't even know if it likes this game and wants to invest in it. You don't know if you like this game. So you send your character in. It gets smashed a lot. It gets dogged on a lot, but guess what? It's also leveling up even when it's getting smashed on. It's also gaining experience. And over time, if you decide at level five, oh yeah, this is a game, this career is something that I really want to be into, then you can start to invest a little bit. Then you can have some more investment and double down and maybe get more and more involved in it. But right now you don't know enough to know whether you want to do this or not. So let your character go in, keep yourself to yourself, preserve your sense of who you are, and allow your character to get smashed or whatever, and along the way, allow it to level up.
Yep, so. Yep. And part of leveling up might be that your character's getting crushed all the time and it's time to pick a different video game, right? It's not the right game for you.
It's not the right game. Oh, it's just not fun. This is not fun. I don't want to spend my life doing this. And that's what I ended up deciding with Law.
Yeah. Go back.
Right,
go to the toy store and get a new video game.
Exactly.
I love it. Thank you, Justin. I love chatting with you, of course. And I appreciate you taking the time to come on here and share your story.
It's my absolute pleasure. And I think the work that you're doing is incredible. I wish everyone would have the good fortune of having to sit down with you and talk to you personally one-on-one, like I do, about what's going on. But in lieu of that, I think you are doing an amazing job of getting your voice out there and getting heard and helping other people get their voices out there and getting heard even by themselves. So
thank you.
That is great stuff. So thank you.
Hey, thanks so much for listening. I hope you found some value in this interview. If so, it would mean the world to me if you hit subscribe, completed an iTunes review, or shared it with a friend. Every little bit counts. I'm super grateful for every single one of you, and I couldn't be more excited to be here. Signing off, I'm Laura Koh, and I'll see you guys next week.